get this, when we have our teleconferences, which the ACS has a teleconference course, and they give up, might be us, a big microphone, and it's terrible because you're stuck for an hour and a half, and the last one was very bad, I guess, and I got very horrible comments about all the students fill out. And something like this, you can walk around and move.
Yeah. and of course, we get much better tape quality this
time. Yeah, well, this is, they have to be able to put this on a telephone, but I'm sure they can.
Oh, they should be able to do that.
Okay, so where were we?
Well, we were just finishing up your comments about your relationship with Paul Poirier up through the early NBS days.
Yeah.
And I guess my next question then, starting at NBS, was what was your first assignment? What was your position went there in 52?
Okay, well, at those days, we talk about those days, particularly about the MBS, the MBS was organized into divisions. There was a heat and power division and some electricity and magnet, and there was an organic and fibrous material division. And in 1952, then each division was subdivided into sections. And in 1952, all the sections were named essentially commodity lines. There was a textile section and a leather section and a plastic, I don't remember them all, and a plastic section and a testing section and a rubber section. And as I mentioned earlier, L.A. Wood was the one who had the position. He was chief of the rubber section. Now, among these commodity sections, the rubber section was somewhat unique because about half of its activity were in basic research. Now, basic research connected with polymers, with rubbers, but not very. And there was a long tradition there because the other senior person there was Norman Beckedahl, who's still alive, living in Pompano Beach. They had early on, L.A. Wood was a physicist and Norm Beck was a chemist, both PhDs. They had early on started to do, 1932, there are some papers by Beckedahl on calorimetry and specific heats of natural rubber. I mean, they were just pioneering. They didn't understand, nobody knew what a polymer was yet in those days, but then their stuff still stands up and is extraordinarily good data. And then Wood came along and he got interested in transitions and melting, and they actually did the first crystallization kinetics using natural rubber, and did some work on melting temperatures and the dependence of melting temperatures on crystallization temperature. So they were quite cognizant of the importance of this kind of work to what their main objectives were, being able to set standards for rubber tires and gaskets. That's what, at the other end of the funnel, so to speak, was happening. And so the section was sort of split in, I'd say, roughly half or one-third, two-thirds. But this commodity influence pervaded everywhere, you see. And it was very, in many ways, it was frustrating because it was difficult to get across to some of the, except for Wood and Beckedahl, to some of the leaders, the older people who head the things. You know, there's a thing called polymers coming on. It's 10 years old now, and these are what you're dealing with. And you're gonna, on the other hand, for a young fellow, my first few years at the Bureau, I feel those were great years because I was on my own. They put very little restraint, some administrative restraints. A lot of the rules and regulations of the government were a little hard to live with. But scientifically, intellectually, they put very little restraint for the first few years. And that was my first assignment. Then to sort of jump ahead in the organization, they finally recognized that there was a thing as polymers. And so they set up a new section called the polymer structure section, which eventually, not the first one off, but eventually Norm Beckedahl got the head. He was the second head. And I would say this was probably about 56, 58 or something like that. And then he'd asked me and took a little bit of a behind-the-scenes maneuvering, and I moved without getting too many feathers ruffled for me to move up. There was a different building to move into the polymer structure section, which essentially took away any of the commodity things. But I didn't feel tremendously stifled in the rubber section to start with. Although, if I had wandered too far away from transitions, crystallinity, and glass temperatures, I think there would have been some mutterings. But so the first 5 or 6 years, I think that they let me do what I wanted, promoted me in proper order, and gave me some help, and we published. There was no restraints on publication. It was encouraged.
But you have a patent also.
Oh, yeah, that's... yeah. That's a,
was that...
Well,
that was just a...
That was sort of like a hobby sort of thing. And just that somebody came through and said, well, you did that, you had somebody from industry. We're always getting visitors. One of the things I didn't like about the Bureau of Standards was the fact that even with appointments and even without appointments, somebody would call up and say, John Jones from so-and-so is here, and he's interested in crystalline polymers. Well, you work for the government. He was a citizen, and then you'd have to do that. And that happened. And also, a lot of people like to come to Washington, so even with appointments, you had to be nice. People would come from all over the world, which is all right, in moderation. But when you got to do 3-4 visitors a week in the springtime, it got to be a little too much. But one, that patent was failed. Well, it was an interesting scientific thing, but the patent was that somebody from industry came by and said, well, you ought to patent that. So I called up the Bureau of Patent people, and they said, well, and they did what they had to do. And we can get to what's involved there. It was part of why I left. One of the reasons, not the major reason, but one of the reasons, the science of it. Yeah, the Bureau to start with was very good, because I didn't nobody bother me. I didn't have to worry about anything administrative, and as long as they could give me reasonable leeway, and I had maybe 2 technicians.
What kind of areas did you pursue then?
Well, primarily in the crystallization area, and some work in glass temperatures, and some collaborative work when I moved into the polymer structure section on solution work. It's back on my old thing with several of the people who were doing solution work, and I just, without bragging, felt I needed a little guidance, and so we got along pretty well. So we did in the papers there was some work on sedimentation equilibrium and sedimentation velocity, and I sort of was like a consultant. But I contributed in terms of saying, well, we're making this effort, why don't we do it this way and learn something scientifically out of it. But basically, the heart of what I did was on some work on glass temperatures, but mostly on crystallization. Are we coming through okay?
Mm-hmm.
Crystallization on the thermodynamics and on the kinetics. Those were the 2 things that we did a whole series of papers on thermodynamics of natural rubber, gutta percha, polyethylene, you just name them. We just established some more of the principles and did a lot of work on kinetics and work on glass.
Who were some of your co-workers?
In the polymer structure section, the people who would do, besides Norm Bechdel and Wood, who were very nice, because they were actually bosses. Bechdel wasn't the boss, but he was very seen. But they were people you could at least have a reasonable scientific discussion with. And there was Bob Marvin, who he may have just retired, who was a rheologist, a student of John Ferry's, and he moved over to some other part of the Bureau to set up a general rheology section somewhere along the lines, I think. And then there was Herb Liedemann, who passed away at a rather early age while I was still at the Bureau. He was a rheologist doing things like creep. And again, this was all very pioneering. I mean, you've got to put it in the times. I mean, people weren't doing these things on a systematic. People knew there was such a thing as creep, anybody who made a rubber. But nobody was really trying to study it from a fundamental point of view. So those are the people there. Then in the polymer structure section, there was Sam Weisberg, who was doing solution work. And Don McIntyre joined us, who's now at the University of Akron. And we had John D. Hoffman with us for a while, but he moved over to another part of the Bureau to set up his own group, which is another story in itself. But those were the main people that were involved. A very important person who was an organic synthesis and mechanism of degradation, Leo Wall, who died in a sailing accident a few years after I left the Bureau. But he was one of the senior. I mean, he wasn't old. He was about my age, but at that time, but was one of the more productive scientists in the place. And he was in the polymer structure section also. And we were sort of 2 parts. We had the physical chemical part and the organic synthesis degradation. Leo made some major contributions to the degradation mechanisms of polymers, and then got interested in fluoropolymers.
You said that Bechdel was the second head of that polymer structure section. Who was the first?
First head was a fellow named Earl Schoonover, who was one time again head of dental materials section at the Bureau in that group too. And Schoonover was he moved on to, I shouldn't make personal comments, moved on to be an associate director or somewhere in the director's office. rather influential, actually, in running the Bureau. Say the last 4 or 5 years I was here, he was probably the most influential person. I was there in running the Bureau from an operational point of view. The other people above him were pretty much dealing with Congress and the President and all that sort of stuff. And when he moved upstairs, so to speak, then Bekedahl, they were very good friends in Bekedahl. There was a whole, the Bureau, in terms of the people who were maybe 10, 15 years older than I was, really a close-knit corporation. I mean, there were a bunch of people that had grown up together, and they knew each other quite well and lived together and drank together and played together, and it was a pretty closed corporation. So,
were there many newcomers like yourself coming in at that time?
There were some. Didn't have the big push that I understand it had lately. Positions were not that... And the newcomers that came in, we weren't interested in what these people were interested in. We were interested in trying to do science, and we got very frustrated sometimes in the directions. But these people were interested more in the politics of science. Not Norm Bekedahl, but all these other grouping people in that age group were more interested in the politics of science, I think, than we're doing. So people are coming like myself, and they were hiring people, and a lot of physicists who were more interested in the science.
Now, you mentioned that the patent was one of the reasons why you ultimately decided.
Well, it wasn't the patent itself. It was the subject matter of the patent. No, the patent was minor. No, you don't leave a place. I mean, actually, there were a lot of reasons. One of them was I had beginning to develop a real strong interest in doing teaching, going back to academics, which was... I began to realize after this was, say, 1958, 59, 60, around that period... So I'd been away from the university for getting close to 10 years, and you don't teach, you don't read, you don't go to that many seminars. I mean, you go to meetings. They were pretty good in letting you go to meetings, but you didn't have a weekly seminar. So you're beginning to lose touch with, you're getting to learn how to make a right-hand thread better and better and better, and that's the way you used to express it. And I had one time I wrote a paper, and I made not a stupid mistake, but I thought something was novel, and it wasn't really. There's almost elementary thermodynamics to tell me that it wasn't. The referee pointed this out, and it sort of dawned on me that maybe I better start studying and learning and refreshing thermodynamics and statistical math. Well, there's no way you can do that except come back and teach. So that was one of the reasons. The other, in terms of that patent, there were three reasons. It all sort of came together, and the patent involved the contractile fibers. We had, following up on that work I told you on the rubber, we followed this up with highly oriented polyethylene, and found out if you cross-linked highly oriented polyethylene, and the Bureau was nice to have all these facilities for radiation, and Leo Wall was doing that and helped me, then you can make a reversibly fiber that changed dimensions reversibly just by melting it. And this built this machine, the thermal engine, that was the patent. But the point is that led us into biological fibers, because and the whole subject of contractility. I mean, just naturally. I mean, nobody said that. I mean, just sort of as you start reading more and more, and we did a lot of work in that Bureau period in keratin and collagen, and the collagen we can carry. We could justify a little bit because it was in they still had the commodity section. The Bureau did not have its reorganization in terms of institutes or what it is today until several years after I left. And so I was getting more interested in this, and it was getting, they hadn't really said anything, but Bekedahl was fine, but I was getting concerned about the people above him who were, because I was very difficult to be a GS-15 that Leo Wall and I were. And we were the only two there, thus far I know in the Bureau, who did not have, at that rank, who didn't have administrative responsibility. Hugo Fano, but he was made to be, I think, a consultant to the director, and his office was in the administrative building. See, Leo's and I were right in the lab like this, and there may have been others, I don't know, but he and I were the only two who knew, who had parking places, and we had lunch in the director's lunch, because that's a certain rank. But it was getting more difficult and difficult to say, well, why are you doing this and not directing a section and doing this and all sorts of that. And also the kind of work I was doing was getting away, you ought to be at NIH doing this, you see. And that wasn't the only thing we're doing, but it was looked then, and it still is, as a very important kind of approach, using basically polymer principles to tackle problems in biological polymers, particularly macroscopic systems, not the solution characterization. And then in the crystallization work, there were essentially three reasons. And this whole problem, as I don't know if you know about it, of this folded chain started to rear its head. And that brought essentially John Hoffman and myself into direct conflict. As I mentioned, he was originally in the polymer structure section, and we got along pretty well. And then he moved over to head what was then the dielectric section, but really it was a device that he could set up his own research program, and this was in another division. But without going into a great deal of technical difficulty, this became a scientific issue, which could have been resolved. There's no reason. I've seen plenty of people here and elsewhere. But it became basically a political situation of a rather serious import. And I was feeling quite harassed in my isolated position, okay? And so in that area, there was a complete misconception, either deliberate or accidental, and misuse of nucleation theory, which I felt very strongly to, which I've been using all the time, and I perhaps unfortunately let my opinions be known. And some people weren't going to let their fame or their potential fame rest on or be halted by something like that. So there was a great deal of harassment, internal problems, internal politics. So the whole thing, so as I started looking around, and as the expression goes, and this institute, and this university was just developing, and Professor Kasha invited me down. And they made me, financially, was actually about the same as I was making at the Bureau. But the rest of it would look very attractive. And in 1962, things were looking very good. So I didn't have no regrets. This was the second best move I made, in a sense. Although the Bureau was, fine. I would say if this problem or this harassment of the folded chains didn't come along, I probably could have handled the other things. Because I was beginning to make contacts with people at NIH, and we could have collaborated, and there was not, driving down Wisconsin Avenue wasn't a great big a deal. And so, fact is, in that period, I did do a paper with Coleman Lockey on muscle, and we are doing. Those problems, I think, and I could have gotten to do some teaching if I wanted to in the Washington area. But everything coming together, and let's say if this other science, sort of political science problem, science political problem, became very serious, actually, it's finally been resolved, hadn't come, I'd probably still be at the Bureau. Because, I'd never been down south before in our lives, and this was a big, but there's no regrets. We've enjoyed every minute of it here, and professionally and personally. But those were I've always told people, my students, and they never should leave a job for one reason unless, it has to be a set of reasons or circumstances that want to make a change. And do you have any questions about this? That's the Bureau period, I think. I have mixed feelings. I still see Wood. I still converse and have interactions with Norm Beckendahl. He's probably in his 80s now and retired in Pompano Beach. Wood was through Florida, was here about 3 years ago, so those people have very good relations, but except for one trip back shortly after I left, I've never been there and never been invited there. I've been invited all over the world, but that's one place. I had one trip back 3 or 4 months to clean up things. I was supposed to be back on a regular basis to clean up things, and a lot of things never got cleaned up, but that's the way life is.
Had you discussed this with Flory at all?
My moving? Oh, yeah.
And the situation at the Bureau?
Oh, yeah, we discussed it on and off. I didn't burden him. It was at that time, we both moved about the same time. He moved 1 year ahead of me, and he was having major problems, too, so we could, in fact, we could commiserate with each other in a certain sense. We were on our own. I wouldn't see him every day or anything like that, but he knew there were problems here, and on this, and he encouraged me. He thought it was time for me to leave there. If I felt strongly as I did that, I wanted to do academic work. See, he moved to Stanford, I think, about a year or a year and a half before we did.
Okay.
I think he went to Stanford in '61, and because I remember. He knew that. he knew that they knew I was coming down here before they even went to Stanford, because I remember going out to see him in Pittsburgh before he left, and he was talking to one of his daughters, and he said I was going to be a professor at Florida State in a half year, because there was a half year interim before I came down. I just had too much going. It's not like you're at a university where you bring your graduate students with you and take your equipment. I just had too many things going, so the deal we struck here was I came down in January rather than in September. I think I accepted the position in the spring, April or May, something like that, yeah. It took me two trips down to convince me that I could be down to Tallahassee, which was all right. It was a very good move. But we struck a deal here that I wouldn't have to come till January, because... I say, it's not like professors say, okay, fellas, pack up the wagons, we're all going to move to someplace else. I couldn't bring anything with me or any of the people. At that time, I had a lot of interactions. I had three or four technical people. They had a postdoctoral program, which every year somebody would come work for me as a postdoctoral. So I cleaned up most everything. There were a few things that could have been finished up, but eventually they got straightened out and started up over again.
Was Florida State the only place you looked at?
I looked at several other places, but this was the only one that made me an offer that I considered reasonable enough to. It was a very exciting place then. It was young. There were 10,000 students, a little under 10,000 or 22,000 then. There was a faculty in chemistry was very good then. I presume it's still pretty good.
I wanted to ask you something about the origin of the of molecular biophysics here, and you just said that it was forming when you
it had been formed. What had happened? The person who basically formed it and involved it was Professor Michael Kasha, whose office is upstairs. He was a fairly eminent physical chemist, spectroscopist. And he'd gotten the idea, I guess from his perspective, it's very similar to mine. Well, he wired it into, I've forgotten, some area of triplet singlet oxygen and found out how important this was, or apparently. So he found out again that here are these biology, biochemical people potting around with things or working with things that he could help them with. And so he'd gotten this idea, and I don't know all these, there were some acts of good coincidence that he was able to get an institutional grant from what was then the AEC. The theme originally, I believe, was to be radiation chemistry and biology, but I think that quickly, by the time I got here, it was. And he got from the state the monies to put this building up. And this is a unique kind of situation. It was then, I still think it is now, that this institute is only a physical facility. It is not an academic enterprise, in a sense. It doesn't. There's no professor of molecular biophysics. You're either a professor of chemistry or a professor of biology, and you happen to be working in the Institute of Molecular Biology. We have, indeed, members here who happen not to, there's not enough space, who are working elsewhere, and it fluctuates slightly. So the theme here was, and at that time, this cornerstone was a rather substantial institutional grant to the from the AEC. If I recall correctly, it was the order of magnitude of about $1 million in 1962, $800,000, $1 million, because I sure it was, because I was associate director effectively for several years and ran the guts of the place, and we were working with a budget from the AEC then of $700,000. So, and there was, we were on the, you know, and they supported it, so the state put up the building with some matching funds, I guess, from somewhere. And this was actually the first building on this part, first scientific building or academic building, if you wish, on this part of the campus. The only other thing was these dormitories, if you saw over here. Mm-hmm. Biology next door and chemistry came some years later. They were all on the other end of the campus. But this is anybody. This is not an academic institution. We also, in this university, give a degree in molecular biophysics, which started about 1969, which is a joint degree. By the biology and chemistry departments. And of course, the institute per se, because of the faculty associated with it, sort of the focus of that program. But again, there are people having students in that program who are next door or next door here. So we profit by having interactions in theory and having central facilities. So that's basically what the institute is. Now, some years ago, we lost the central grant, and it's sort of everything is running on its own.
So each of the faculty that are involved would traditionally then supply their own.
Yeah, well, we all were doing some then, but right. We had the central thing that, and but as a consequence of how it originated, we have a set of central facilities. We have a shops. We have offices and people who take care of all the bookkeeping and paperwork. So it takes a burden also off the department. Sort of works both ways. If they took the five chemistry professors who are in this building and dumped them into chemistry, it would cause a great deal of problems for chemistry, I can assure you, and vice versa. There are about 8 or 9 people in here, 4 or 5 from chemistry or 4 or 5 from biology. It fluctuates slightly as people leave and somebody else moves in. But when I first came here, this building was just going up, and so I had temporary quarters in the old chemistry building, and I was the original people who still left, who moved into this, who were still in this building.
Who was the third one?
Rhodes, a young professor. He was a young assistant professor. He was he's a theoretical quantum mechanician. And I think I'm right. Yeah, there are still some people in chemistry who are here, but they moved into chemistry when the new chemistry, this big building here is a chemistry building.
You were director of the...
Well, I was associate director for about 4 years, I think 70 to 74 or 69, and I essentially did, and I took care of things. It was a fairly... It was a time-consuming thing because you had to make decisions how to distribute a fairly good-sized chunk of money, and you had a lot of interactions with the people in Washington and Gaithersburg. It took a lot out of me physically.
I was going to ask how you appreciated administrative aspects.
Not particularly. Well, and so, yes and no. Here it was not that difficult. It was a pretty congenial crew here, and we got along reasonably well. We got pretty straight answers from the people in the AC, and so we had to embark on a program of trying to reach a steady state with them now in financing and working the rest up. And it wasn't too bad, except there was a lot. At any large state university, when you get into something like that, maybe any place, you just get into all the actual obligation, the responsibility wasn't so bad. That I could make the couple of trips a year to the AEC and work with the crew here, how we're going to distribute our money and hire. We have, administrative people, so, and they were pretty good. We had a pretty good crew. We had to do that. But it's the everyday thing of having to go to 2-3 meetings every week or every day. I mean, just I used to have 2 secretaries. And one was doing my work, and one was, and they would just, I got sick. I was out for a year for one time. They just point me in, and I go home and stay up all night doing my work, you see. And, of course, you have to go to the science area committee, and then you'd have to go to the dean, have this, and the president, have that. I don't mean social functions. I mean, most of them are a waste of time, but you have to go to the building committee. If you didn't go, then somebody would take half your building away from you, you see. And so that. Really had to do because we had a good crew and we had sufficient flexibility that with a good lead time. You see, I had a colleague who was on leave in Sweden in those days making a long distance call. It looked like we were going to get a big budget cut, and I just called up Bob Fisher. I said, "You better be prepared when you come back, all the money you thought you're going to have." Well, people could work with that. And so that part, I was able to do all right. And we had some people who were technicians, and I told them, well, you better tell your technician the next year or two to find another job. At least that's why, because it looks like we're not going to be able to keep the crew that we have. And so nobody ever got really hurt. We have a pretty congenial sort of group to work with, and we managed to have competent people help us downstairs. But this other stuff killed me. I was out for you. I was sick, right? I just couldn't take it. I mean, just, maybe I don't know about your place, but it's... and I felt the responsibility very strongly. I knew if I didn't go to a meeting of the building committee, then somebody's going to take a lab away from us. And
Let's change pace for a moment. I think it's the award citation for the ACS Polymer Award. There are a number of statements that are made. Well, you were called Mr. Crystalline Polymer, and you had 2 books that I wanted to go back to. First one, 64, and the crystallization of polymers. Mm-hmm. What led up to the writing of that book?
Well, several. There were. I haven't thought about that in some time, but I think that there were several intellectual reasons, the scientific reasons, and also the physical situation. The timing was right. At that time, with the work that Florey had done and the work I had done with him and a lot of other people, one could begin to see, I think, the basics of the subject. And at the same time, there was a lot of this new work on morphology that was coming in that had a lot of elements of merit, but also was beclouding the perspective of the problem I thought was being lost. So there was very basic science that could be discussed, and I felt something I was subject I was obviously close to. I'd been working on it since 1949, and I think that the new work on morphology and structure and the lamellar crystallized, which were important, were, at least if they weren't incorrect, which turned out most of them were, but at that time at least they were, a lot of ideas were being propounded without really substantive thing, and the whole subject I thought was getting out of perspective. And since I knew I was going to be moving sooner or later, I mean, at this time I started the book in, say, 60, 61, so I came here with a first draft, a rough draft. And then, as I said, the labs weren't ready when I came here, so I was able to really, I had a little cubbyhole in the library and then finished it up. Did that answer your question? That's what sort of promoted it. Are we off the tape?
I'm going to have to.